Alright, so today is May 24th, 2017, and this is Anne Halbert Brooks. I'm here with Catherine Murphy to interview her about the collection that she is donating to UNC on the Cuban Literacy Campaign of 1961. So I guess the first question is, Catherine, how did you first come to Cuba?
So I first went to Cuba in 1992, but I had grown up thinking about Cuba my whole life because I grew up very close to my dad's mother and her sister. That's my grandmother, you know, my paternal grandmother and my paternal great aunt. And they had both been born and raised in Cuba. And my grandmother in 1910... and her sister just a few years earlier. Their parents were North Americans who lived and worked in Cuba temporarily. They were working in, you know, building sugar mills. My great-grandmother worked for the Cuban Red Cross, and my great-grandfather, I guess it was the American Red Cross in Cuba, and my grandfather worked for like a construction company, and they built, you know, worked on sugar mills and railroads and things like that. No one in my family has a ton of details, although my great-grandmother wrote memoirs about Cuba sometime in the 30s. They're pretty interesting. So my grandmother, you know, and my great-aunt grew up in Cuba, and then I grew up very close to them, especially to my great-aunt, who sort of took care of my sister and I. Like, we grew up very, you know, she sort of semi-raised us, right? My mother started medical school at Stanford when I was 4 and my sister was 2, and my great aunt babysat us every day. So this might be too much detail, but anyway, so we sort of like heard stories about Cuba all the time. It wasn't just like this occasional thing. It was really like, you know, a very common occurrence over a number of span of years of our lives. So I guess I sort of always knew I wanted to go, or like had that piece of this felt very connected to that piece of like our family history or whatever. Definitely, you know, especially through my great aunt who was so, and my grandma. My grandma, who was so, felt so Cuban and was so connected to Cuba and spoke about Cuba a lot through her whole life. So I first went in 1992, and I was doing an undergraduate degree in California, and I sort of, you know, designed a group of... Is that going to be a problem for you if there's other noise? Because
yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, and we're back. So how did you first hear about the literacy campaign?
You know, I actually feel like there's another part of this previous question that was maybe a little more interesting. I think I was giving too much, like, way background detail. But because I went to Cuba for the first time in 92, it's like it was full-on special period. And I had no way to anticipate that or prepare for that, really. So it was really fascinating and really challenging in a lot of ways. But it just made the whole kind of... I was fascinated with how Cuba was dealing with the special period and I guess this kind of maybe bridges one question to the next, so I don't want to make it hard for you to separate them, but you can, you know, do whatever you need to do. But, you know, I was fascinated with how a country with very low resources would sort of just grapple with survival and then with issues of development and human services and... So, you know, while I was sort of living this immediate daily reality of the special period, I was also really struck with and really fascinated by the social system that Cuba had built, you know, this education system, the healthcare system, and how a low-resource developing world country would make such a strong commitment to that and actually make it happen. So I was interested in those topics, and I ended up, you know, enrolling in the University of Havana and doing a master's degree at the Flaxo program. And that is a master's program on sustainable development issues, right? So they're looking at sort of development theory concepts and conceptualizations around development. What is development? And looked a lot at like the UN definitions of development. You were looking at, you know, a lot of the theoreticians, development theory theoreticians, but also looking at sort of working definitions of development used by United Nations and UN institutions, and looking at this kind of new or relatively new at the time, like concepts around sustainable development, which both the social and environmental aspects, right? So I had been, was researching in that, and my research topic was not the, or my master's thesis topic was not the literacy campaign, but it sort of bridged together, you know, the sort of just general interest in like how Cuba was using, was exploring notions of development and then putting social development, their own kind of social development practices into, you know, action, into place, and sort of designing their own model of social development and trying, you know, key piece of which has been trying, you know, providing basic services to people who, you know, in most of the rest of the world would not have access to those services. So that interested me in terms of issues of global equity. And I, you know, I don't want to go off on a big tangent, but, you know, I had been connected to a lot of low-income community organizing in the United States. And so I was sort of thinking a lot about how we might evolve our model of social development in the United States, or like, you know, extending, have a more efficient way to extend network of social protections, etc. So, so I was doing this research or studying at the University of Havana at the same time as meeting all these people. So I was, in my process of researching, I met a number of really interesting men and women doing, you know, cutting edge work in the Cuba of today, or say in contemporary Cuba, because of course it was a number of years ago now. But it just so happened that, you know, on a regular basis, like a number of these people had been literacy teachers. And I was meeting them because of the work they were doing in Cuba today, but several of them referenced their experiences as literacy teachers as the most important thing they had ever done. And that just, you know, really intrigued me and kind of gripped me. So I just, you know, and so that was sort of there. And then, you know, one of the women in the Maestro film, Daisy Vetia, who became a hospital architect, I knew her very well, and she was one of the people who would say that she thought, you know, she really had done huge and wonderful things in her life. But she was one of the people that always would say that she thought, she felt like the most beautiful thing she had ever done was teach someone else to read and write when she was a teenager, a group of people she taught, maybe 6 or 7 people. And so it just, I don't know, it fascinated me and intrigued me. It sort of gripped me, the story. And it was the first interview that we did in 2003 was an interview with Daisy Vetia. And it was sort of a life story. She was very ill, and I had sort of recently found out that she was probably terminally ill. So we recorded, you know, really, I felt in a rush to do a recorded interview with her. And I think I sort of had this idea in my mind, but that at that point, it kind of became concrete. So I got a film crew of some Cuban film people that I knew. And we went over to her house and did a really wonderful filmed interview with her, in which I was just totally, it was so much more than I expected. Like, I was so impressed with how, or so struck by how fresh all the memories were to her. It was like she remembered, you know, people, places, names, dates, times, like all of this detail she talked about as if it had been like yesterday or, you know, just last week or something. And so that was that in itself was fascinating. And she also really encouraged me, not even in a general way, but she knew, you know, some of the people. Like in her interview, she names, oh, you know, me and Aide Vasquez Medina and whoever, you know, she remembered all the people that she was with. And she really had encouraged me to interview a couple of them. And I never did interview them. I never got in touch with them. I didn't, you know, follow up enough to like track them down. But what I did is to start interview other women that I knew who had been literacy volunteers, like Norma Guillard, who's a leading social scientist in Cuba, in the Cuba of today, and has done a lot of groundbreaking work around race and gender equality issues. And she's also worked a lot with the LGBT community. And she just had such a beautiful story. And she's originally from Santiago de Cuba, so she had that whole angle. I also interviewed Hina Ray, who was one of the founders, who was an architect and an urban planner, was one of the founders of the Grupo de Desarrollo Integral de la Capital. And she just had a beautiful story also. So, you know, I think what I had sort of been expecting was that I'd do a few interviews and edit kind of a small film that would be meaningful for Cuba and meaningful for the world, or for the U.S. in particular, which would meant a lot to me. And in a way, I think I did it for myself, like for them and for myself. Like, it was hard to separate. It was a deeply personal project from the beginning. I also started doing the interviews in 2003, which was like where I was sort of wrapping up my Cuba years. I felt like I was sort of wrapping up things in Cuba, getting ready to move back to the States. So there was some piece of it that felt like a bridge, like a wonderful bridge from what I had learned in Cuba, and, you know, sort of getting to see the other side of the story about Cuba, and bring that, some of a piece of that back to the U.S., you know, some core piece about what is, you know, the best parts of what has been happening in Cuba in previous decades, right, that we don't get a chance to hear about in the U.S. So, but those first three interviews, rather than kind of just creating a feeling where, or, you know, a sense where I thought, oh, this is a great project, so glad I did it. It was just like the tip of an iceberg. They were so emotionally, you know, still after all these years, almost 50 years later, 45 years or so at the time, they were so connected. That's, my math is wrong. It's not 45 years, but it was, because it would have been 40 in 2001. So it was 42 years, right? But that's a long time. So, but the fact that they just remembered everything, that they were so immediate about it and so passionate about it and so emotionally connected to that story still, it really struck me, and I just riveted me. And so I kind of continued to do interviews, and the idea of the project kind of grew, the conception of the project kind of grew into being, you know, a larger film, you know, more than a 10-minute film. And although the Maestra film is only, you know, we just selected 9 of those interviews to edit a half an hour film, you know, I did dozens of interviews. Right. You know the number better than I do.
More than 100, I think. Yeah. All told.
So, yeah, and then at some point I just thought, you know, it just sort of grew and snowballed. At some point I thought, oh, this is such a huge story. You know, I really hadn't done a lot of background research in the campaign. Mm-hmm. I was really more interested in this sort of testimonial, you know, this, like, the testimonies around these very personal experiences. And especially for the young women, which we can come back to later. But I hadn't done a lot of research on the campaign. Their story struck me so much, I started to do some research on the campaign. And you know, so just the significance of the magnitude of the campaign itself, you know, 100,000 teenagers, 250,000 volunteer teachers, you know, 100,000 of whom were teenagers, you know, carrying out this massive national campaign for literacy. It's sort of an impossible feat. It's a seemingly impossible feat.
Right.
So I just became fascinated on all these levels of just the campaign itself, and then the magnitude of it, what it might mean for the rest of the world, mm-hmm. right? And what it meant in a long-term way for the young people in particular who had been those young teachers, you know, how it had changed them.
So now with this vantage point of more than 50 years and more than 100 interviews, are there any that particularly stand out to you that were particularly meaningful for your understanding or that you think explain it especially well?
Yes. I mean, I think that a number of the interviewees, I mean, since we were just talking about Daisy Beitia, right? She said that she felt like the being on the campaign totally changed her life because that was where she found a strong sense of self, like empowerment or self-esteem. She had been a very shy, very quiet, very kind of sheltered child, you know, young woman, girl and young woman. With very limited, you know, her parents didn't even like to let her go to the corner store by herself. So she just broke out of that and discovered that she was actually, you know, smart and capable and, you know, brave and courageous and could solve problems and kind of had something huge to give the world. Yeah. And a lot of the interviewees, especially the young women, talk in those terms. It changed the world for them, and it changed the way they saw the world, and it changed the way they saw themselves, because they discovered all these things that had been, you know, prohibited for young women before, up to that time, you know, being strong or autonomous or brave or like things that were not really cultivated in young women. You know, you weren't supposed to be that way if you're a young woman. So they kind of got into all this forbidden, exciting territory, and many of them never looked back. So there's so many different interviews that I could say, like pieces of which stick out with, and that I think about a lot. But one of them was the interview with Silvio Rodriguez, the Trovador. You know, one of Latin America's most beloved singer-songwriters. He taught on the literacy campaign when he was 14 years old. And he, the family that he was teaching how to read and write, they didn't know the world was round. And so he just was saying, like, imagine, you know, how, when you're 14 years old, and you've received this kind of minimal training to teach people like how to make the alphabet. Of course, they had the books and the cartilla and manual and that, you know, but their training was really to teach people like ABD, you know, ABCD, you know, basic reading and writing, how to hold a pencil, how to, and to be confronted with these major issues like the world, you know, not knowing that the world is round. And that, you know, there's so much in that. First of all, what huge challenges those young teachers had to raise up, you know, face. You know, pedagogical challenges, like human challenges, yeah, right. Teaching challenges, pedagogical challenges. But it also really drives home how marginalized they were. Like how so, you know, many areas of the rural population in particular, mountainous populations in the east, you know, in the Sierra Maestra or the Escambray, or the coastal people where he was teaching on the southern coast, had little or no access to education. So it was just, you know, so those kind of stories really stuck out to me of like, you know, Silvio Rodriguez talking about his family didn't know the world was round, or someone else I talked to that was up in this way high up in the Sierra Maestra, that some of their students like didn't really understand that they lived on an island. You know, or they hadn't seen the Cuban flag, or they hadn't seen Jose Marti, or they just these kind of elements, like basic elements of universal education now in Cuba that are like, you know, primary school, were totally foreign to people. Some of the people in these very, very, you know, rural communities. So, yeah.
So what seem to be some common goals or motivations for your interviewees in participating in your project?
It's really interesting because it was the first question that I asked all of them. And I think I expected a little bit more sort of lofty or ideological responses. Some of them had those responses, but many others were just like, you know, it was an adventure. It was a way, I should actually say in all fairness, you know, some were motivated by these sort of, big ideas or ideologies. Many others were motivated by the idea of teaching. Like many of them say that they were drawn by the idea of teaching, the importance of like teaching, you know, their country people how to read and write, teaching illiterate adults how to read and write. But many others also just say like, you know, it was like the spirit of adventure. They were like swept up in the spirit of adventure. All my friends were going and I wanted to go too, or, you know, that just some, that spirit of adventure, getting away from home. I think for a lot of the young women also, just this getting out of, from the very overly protective clutches of what the family structure was in the 1950s, for young women was a huge attraction. So though, you know, they had diverse answers, but they generally fit in those categories, and the adventure piece was big for everybody.
So one thing that you see sometimes reading memoirs of the 1950s is a lot of discussion of how women weren't allowed out without a chaperone because their reputations might be tarnished. Did you see them negotiating that issue of maybe having a threat to their reputation if they went off into the mountains like this?
That's a really interesting question. I actually think that was a major motivating factor for the parents who would not let their daughters go. Mm-hmm. In fact, I've heard about or know about several cases of families who sent their daughters to the United States to stop them from going on the literacy campaign. That the threat of the daughter going on the literacy campaign being a major, possibly the primary factor in like rushing and hurrying up and getting them out. I've spoken to at least two or three Cuban women living in the U.S., Cuban American women, I think Cuban, you know, Cuban women whose family sent them on the Peter Pan, you know, who left Cuba as part of the Operation Peter Pan. And their families were like rushing to get them out of Cuba because they wanted to go on the literacy campaign. And, you know, there were certainly, there could be many elements to that. Political elements, of course. But there was a huge gender element in that. You know, both, I think, the threat of becoming, you know, breaking all those gender norms, but certainly this whole unchaperoned, what might happen, the reputations, you know, threat of romance and young men, you know, especially if they were, you know, associated with the revolution or maybe campesinos, farmers. So there's a lot of class issues there too, and rural urban prejudices there too. But one of the women who told me that story was an incredible Cuban woman named Olga Vives. Mm-hmm. Don't think she would identify with Cuban American, I think. I'm not sure if she would identify as Cuban or Cuban American. I could try to ask one of her nieces who I know before you publish, but and her nieces are all Cuban American. They came as babies. But she said that her parents tried to stop her. They sent her on the Peter Pan Brigade, you know, Peter Pan, Operation Peter Pan, in order to stop her from going on the literacy campaign because they were afraid that she would become like a strong autonomous woman or something maybe resembling a feminist. Well, she became a major feminist leader in the United States and became like the national vice president of NOW, National Organization for Women. And so she sort of chuckled about that. And she's unfortunately passed away a few years ago, so we're never able to do a recorded interview with her. But yeah, she was one of the cases, and there's a couple more. She was sort of the funny case because she's like became this feminist leader, you know, and maybe she was just dying for that autonomy already. But there are a few other Cuban women I've spoken to whose parents rushed them out. Well, the other young women, they really engaged in this, you know, serious negotiation with their parents. And that, you know, if you think there were 50,000 teenage girls that went on the literacy campaign, many of them really had to take on their parents. They had to enter into this intensive process of negotiation with their parents to be able to go. Many of the parents didn't want them to go at first, especially the dads didn't want them to go. But they entered into negotiation, and that was, I mean, I really have come to see that negotiation as the first step toward, you know, this new era for, you know, for Cuban women, for young, yeah, this group of young women and for Cuban women in general. And most of those women, I mean, the ones that, many of the young women that I talk to, you know, then young women, they just loved so much what they discovered about themselves, you know, that they never looked back. They broke out of that little box and they never looked back.
So how did you go about recruiting interviewees to give these testimonials?
That's interesting. Well, because I started with people I knew, I started with women, a group of women that I knew, and it just kind of spread. I mean, I did those first three interviews in 2003, and I planned to have those be the end, but then when I really realized that there was so much more to tell and to explore, you know, and then I kind of went into this farther phase. I started to tell you earlier, but ended up going somewhere else with my comment, but I think, you know, I really hit a point where I just thought this was such a massive phenomenon. There's thousands of stories, like of testimonies to be collected, and it was such a peak moment in the, I really came to see it as a peak moment in the social history of the Americas, and certainly a peak moment in education history. So I kind of felt at one point like I was racing against the clock, like, well, I just have to do as many interviews as I can, or, you know, I was putting the word out, and that was when I brought in a couple, like, research associates, Yvonne Chapman and Alina Marquez, who did some research work for me, looking for new interviewees and doing digital audio recordings, which are part of the archive collection that we'll be donating to UNC. But, you know, it wasn't too hard to get the word out, both by people who had taught on the campaign themselves or had some kind of another role. Also, a lot of friends my generation had parents that taught on the campaign, or some friends younger than me had grandparents. There's a woman named Ana Maria Rojas who was part of the National Commission that for the literacy campaign that put together the teaching materials, the pedagogical materials, and compiled the Cartilla y Manual. And I was able to interview her because of meeting her granddaughter. And her granddaughter was actually a good friend of Yvonne Chapman. So it's like, it just sort of all, I don't know, snowballing isn't the right word, but it just sort of spread, you know. And there were this sort of organic process of a lot of people, you know, spread partly through word of mouth. But, you know, I had Yvonne Chapman working on it, and then a good friend of hers who was Ana Maria Rojas's granddaughter contacted me and said, you know, told me about her grandmother, and that was how we ended up doing that collective interview with the living members of the National Commission. And then I also went to the Literacy Museum in Havana when the director, Luisa Campos, helped me also. You know, I asked them for just to get into their archives, but I also asked for suggestions of people. And one of the people that Luisa Campos and the museum suggested was Griselda Aguilera. And Griselda Aguilera was the youngest girl teacher. She taught one person, one 58-year-old man named Carlos Perez Isla, who was totally illiterate. She taught him how to read and write, you know, basic reading and writing in 1961. And, you know, I just couldn't believe that story. It wasn't believable to me that a 7-year-old. So I know, you know, I tracked her down, but maybe almost more out of incredulousness than out of, you know, the fascination or something, I don't know, interest with her story. I was really interested in her story, but I just couldn't imagine it was true. And we actually interviewed her at the Literacy Museum. And wow, her story is really true, and it's quite spectacular, you know, and she tells a piece of it in the Maestro film, and it's always one of the moments that sticks out to people the most, you know, and she insisted on going, and of course she was seven. Her parents taught on the literacy, were both teaching on the literacy campaign in Havana, and, you know, it's not in the film, but she says, like, she just felt like they were getting up every morning, they'd leave the house like they were going to do something so important. And she wanted to be part of that, but she was so young, you know, they didn't take her seriously. But of course she was reading at a, you know, she was in first grade and she was reading more to second or third grade level. So she had a lot to teach that many adults had never had the opportunity to learn. And she did it.
So it seems like you've been able to get really overwhelming response to this project from potential interviewees. What are some of their reasons, do you think, for wanting to be interviewed, especially at this point? Is it a similar sense that they're racing against the clock? Is it something about the environment at this point?
I think on the one hand, people are so proud of they're so proud of it. Like it was such an important experience for them, a life-changing experience, a transformative experience for them on a personal level, very important. And it's something that they're very proud of. And especially as history goes by and it's just sort of, you know, the importance of whole undertaking. So they're really proud of it. And although I must say, like, I don't feel like anyone, there's no one sticks out to me right now that talked about it in that boastful, you know, like, oh, I was, you know, part of something really important. They hold its importance in a very different way. It's much more personal, and because it's service, it's such a key piece of the story is about the transformative power of service, mm-hmm. and the lasting importance of that in the lives of all of these thousands of young teachers who really experienced it, you know, day in, day out, living with their students, working with their students, learning about the lives of rural people, learning about the challenges of rural people, and working together with them, and then taking, you know, the dedication of teaching them how to read and write. And being in, you know, that is, like, the power of that, it, you know, but in this very, like, personal way, is very lasting. Mm-hmm. So people are proud of that, you know. Like, honored might be more the word. It's like they filled some kind of... what I felt like I read from it, right, was that... and I also feel like there was really an element just in the crisis that Cuba has been going through in the special period, the post-Soviet period, from 1989 to now, where life has just been so challenging on so many levels. I felt like people, you know, that might have had a piece of why so many of those who participated in the literacy campaign were so happy and excited to talk about it. It's like, you know, this is what I'm about, or this is what we're about, and in spite of all the challenges now and the difficulties, like, this is the core thing that we, you know, or want to be building. So it was almost sort of just remembering, you know, bringing back and then transmitting kind of what they were working to build at that time.
So what reception have you seen to the film Maestra and any other projects that you've done with these materials in the U.S. and then in Cuba? Are there differences?
Yes. I want to actually add something to the last thing, too. Sure. You know, I made a point of reaching out to a number of people who no longer live in Cuba. Mm-hmm. You know, there were a group of Latin American young people who volunteered on the campaign, non-Cuban young people who came to Cuba in 1961 and volunteered on the campaign. And I did reach a couple of them and interviewed a couple of them. Well, I suppose I also reached out to a number of Cubans who no longer live in Cuba, you know, because while there were people that came abroad that weren't Cuban, there also were a lot of Cubans who lived in Cuban 96 and subsequently left. And I did do a few verbal interviews in Miami. The people that I interviewed in Miami asked not to be recorded. But they were very forthcoming. I probably talked to three different people in Miami. And then I did a filmed interview with a gentleman who now lives in San Francisco, California. Jose Luis Gomez. And I think that's the only one I'm trying to remember. But, you know, San Francisco is one social political context and Miami is another. So, you know, it's interesting. It was interesting to me that, and understandable that the people I spoke to in Miami really wanted to have a first conversation, you know, asked to not be recorded, at least during the first conversation. And it was also really interesting that they, in spite of having, you know, broken with the project of the Cuban Revolution and having very different political, you know, opinions, feelings, perspectives, did feel like it was a beautiful experience for them as young people and seemed to really feel that it was a meaningful, genuinely meaningful undertaking. And that it was important to them personally in some ways. But they, you know, feel really differently about things now. You know, they left either on their own volition or in some cases their parents left. But in many cases they chose to leave themselves. There's a whole other story there that would be very interesting for someone to explore. Mm-hmm. But... yeah, so that's the next question.
Okay. So what reception have you seen to the film and to stories about the campaign in the U.S. and Cuba?
Yeah. Well, definitely. I mean, in Cuba a lot, I've really enjoyed that it's been shown in Cuba quite a bit. And... or maybe I should say this the other way around. I mean, in Cuba, let me say it the other way around. You know, showing it in the U.S., people are just like, they can't believe it. It's just, again, it's just this seemingly impossible story. And so people in the U.S., like, they see it. And we've been showing it. The film was released in 2012, or now 2017. It's enjoyed a very robust distribution for 5 years, which is, you know, not always, you know, not all in mid-length independent documentaries enjoy that. So that's been really wonderful and special. But, like, people see it and they just kind of go, well, wait, you know, they did what? They did when? They were how many? Well, what? How is it possible? Like, there's just, like, it's just stunning or shocking or unbelievable, you know. So there's always a little bit of that. And people are also really inspired, you know. Mass illiteracy or illiteracy remains a major unsolved global problem. It remains an unsolved problem in the United States. It's largely invisible or invisibilized in the U.S. So it's sort of like illiteracy is all around us all the time, but we just haven't really, you know, it's so invisible that we haven't really learned to, like, see it or look for it or talk about it or find a national solution, right? So I think the film just really strikes people. The story strikes people. How did they do that? And how is it possible? And, well, couldn't we try to do something like that? Couldn't the rest of the world could do that? Or couldn't we try to do that here too? And people are also sometimes really surprised, like, and sort of shocked, or even, you know, if what if most of what they've heard about Cuba has been very negative, it's hard sometimes for people to believe that what they've heard, you know, could coexist with like this incredibly, you know, some incredible story of a nation trying to overcome illiteracy and all of these young teachers being part of it. So sort of like they grapple with how to hold those two things together. And in Cuba, it's been really special and wonderful to show it in Cuba, but it's almost like the opposite, or I don't want to say the opposite, but, you know, a lot of younger generations Cubans have come to me and said, kind of thanked me for the story in a way, the way that we showed the film of, you know, they've heard about the literacy campaign, of course, all their lives. Like, people in Cuba know there's such a strong sense of history, and people know their history, you know, in general. People know their history. There's a lot of connection between history and the present. You know, people feel connected to history. And they know about the literacy campaign, but they maybe know more about kind of the macro political story, or maybe you could even say a more sloganistic version of the story, with the sort of, you know, heroicism of the historic leaders, whatever. And so this, to sort of tell the story from the vantage point of everyday heroes and heroines and just regular people and what a huge role they played in it all, I've appreciated that a number of young people in Cuba have come, like, specifically thanked me for that, and that they felt like it gave them a new perspective on what that phenomenon was. So that, you know, that's been really nice.
And so you've touched on this a little bit already, but you focus, especially in Maestra, and a lot of the focus of the larger project is on women, even though I think it's almost half of your interviewees have been men. What's the goal with that? And what are you hoping to do by focusing on women particularly?
Yeah, I think when I set out to collect the first stories, I was really looking for stories of women and for the stories of the youngest women and how this experience changed, you know, may have changed the way they saw themselves. Sort of this thing about the country was changing, and, you know, what was that connection between a country going through a massive process change and how that, you know, can be lived on a personal, you know, what's the connection between the macro transformation and the micro? Of course, it's very, very, very different. But in the particular instance of the literacy campaign, kind of how did that change the lives of young women, or especially the way that young women saw themselves vis-a-vis this larger project, or through, and I think I came to see it more as like through these new opportunities that were afforded to them or that were available to them because of this larger project of the literacy campaign. So they were able to break out of those very narrow confines of, you know, the gender roles that existed in Cuba in the 1950s. And there's, you know, there's a lot of race and class dynamics in that as well, because lower income women were sort of always had to work, right? Mm-hmm. But any family that could afford to not have the daughters work, like, the daughters didn't work. So definitely, like, middle class families, the daughters were sort of, you know, were just very, very protected. Like, they had, you know, not leaving the house with a chaperone, and, you know, learning to walk with a book on your head, or sort of that the way to cultivate a good future was for them, like, quote-unquote good future in that mainstream social, you know, dominant culture social construct at the time of, like, you know, learn how to walk, you know, the whole thing. And there's a scene in the movie, like, learning to walk with a book on your head and, like, you know, just be a proper lady and learn how to be a good wife and a good mother. And, like, it's important to be a good wife and a good mother in the larger sense of the world, but if that's all, or it could be, you know, I mean, but if that's all you have open to you, and there's total exclusion of the public sphere, an intellectual life, a spiritual life, an artistic life, some autonomy, you know, or any autonomy. So You know, that I was really curious about that, and the literacy, the young women that participated in the literacy campaign, because they were able to break out of that so much, it was life changing for them. And so, you know, that really, really interested me. At the same time, you know, it was transforming for the men too. You know, the young men that participated in the literacy campaign were profoundly transformed. And it didn't really dawn on me till some years into the project that it also transformed them around gender confines. It also gave them some movement beyond the very strict gender confines of like men and young, you know, men and what men are supposed to be or whatever. Now, there was a big difference in terms of the way the parents reacted, right? Mm-hmm. So when the young men went to tell their parents they wanted to join the literacy campaign, the parents generally approved. And it, you know, it fit into that sort of those Western-like concepts of, like, you know, manhood, masculinity, go out in the world and, you know, find your way in the world, become a man. But when the young women told their parents they wanted to go, like, most of the parents adamantly refused because, you know, they were worried. It was dangerous, and it was dangerous. There were a lot of reasons for parents to worry, but a lot of that worry was around breaking gender norms. Mm-hmm. So that was really fascinating terrain for me, and it was something that I wanted to explore through the interviews. At the same time, you know, there were all these incredible men that were on the project. There were, like, all these incredible guys. It was about half and half. It was slightly over half of the young teachers were young women. But the other almost half were young men. You know, and again, like, it vale la repetición, as they say. Like, it was a profoundly transformative experience for them. So when I started to run into men who I knew, or, you know, friends of friends, or friends' parents, you know, dads or uncles or grandpas or whatever, I started to interview them. Many of those interviews actually happened after the Maestro film was already edited. I did a few before, but I would come across these incredible stories, like, oh, Enrique Pineda Barnett, he was the first Maestro Voluntario. And he was old friends with Ivan Napolis, who was our cinematographer from Ekaik. And so Ivan Napolis was saying, you know, you've got, like, how could you not interview? You've got to interview. You're doing the literacy. You've got to. So, you know, he, like, almost insisted. And it was, of course, a fascinating story. So we did. We all went together. We went to his house. We spent an afternoon with him. We interviewed him about the experience and also watched together with him this archival Cuban film called Maestro del Cilantro, which he stars in, and it's sort of about him in some way. Like, it's sort of about his experience, not entirely. But that was totally, you know, wonderful. And then, you know, they knew someone else, and there were other people. We interviewed Daniel Diaz, who founded Televisión Serrana, which was initially a UNESCO project in the Eastern Mountains of Cuba. Well, he fell in love with the Eastern Mountains of Cuba when he was, you know, on the literacy campaign, when he was teaching literacy. Or Jose Fuster, who's this wacky painter, ceramicist, who was a literacy volunteer in 1961 and said he'd spent his whole life painting the scenes that he saw on the literacy campaign. You know, so it's like this, there are these deep, lasting stories for the guys. And so I didn't want to, like, exclude them, you know. And also, sort of funny, because when I started first joining the Maestro film in Cuba, I can't remember if I told you this before, like, numerous men came up to me and they were like, nos dejaste fuera. Nos dejaste fuera. And at first I kind of thought, well, this is right, this is how women have felt, like, throughout the ages. But you know, but it's not just that simple. There are, you know, they have had so many beautiful experiences and beautiful things to tell. So, yes, so I started interviewing more men. I actually had done a number of interviews, research interviews with men, like with Jorge Odio, who has a beautiful story because he was came from a very, very poor family in Palma Soriano, and he had never been able to go to school because he didn't have shoes, which is was a common story. I heard that many times. So when the campaign started, he signed up to be a student. But it's like he was more the age of the young brigadista volunteers. So he took the classes for a few days, or I don't remember exactly how many days, a few days, and then he ran away from home and like appeared in the next town presenting himself as a literacy volunteer. And they gave him students, and he taught these people how to read and write. And he said he would like stay up, you know, reading, studying the lessons furiously before he would like teach them the next day. So there was just so many beautiful stories told by the guys. And we actually, you know, by the various men that we interviewed. And, of course, the Sylvia Rodriguez story that I shared with you earlier. And I did a special edit for the 50-year anniversary of the campaign with a wonderful Cuban editor named Manuel Iglesias. Manuel Iglesias took, I just gave him all of the transcripts that I had prepared for Maestra and all of the interviews that we had digitized, and he did a special edit that we titled 1961, just with numbers, just 1961. And we screened that in Cuba, and it has the stories of men and women. And there was this, a really wonderful soundtrack largely done by Lucia Huergo, a leading woman, Cuban composer, and she's done a lot of bandas sonoras. I can't remember the word in English. Soundtracks for films. So that's never been subtitled into English. So I've shown it a couple times in Spanish. I've shown it in Cuba, and I've shown it at a couple academic conferences in the States that were bilingual or that have a heavy focus on Spanish. I was at Secolas, I don't want to say wrong. There was an Ohio Latin American Studies Association that showed it in Spanish with no subtitles. So, yes, the men's stories are wonderful, too, and very important for history. And I'm very glad that we're giving them to UNC and that hopefully more people will research in them and create other fine things that I missed in the nuances.
I guess for any potential future researchers, anywhere that you would recommend them start?
Oh, very interesting. I guess it just depends so much on where, you know, what aspect they're looking at or looking for. It's hard to say. You know, it would be interesting to start to sort of look at the differences, like the regional differences. I don't know. You know, I mean, I think the things that stick out to me wouldn't necessarily be the most interesting. I mean, I don't know that they would necessarily, but, you know, if there were, like, if there were one thing that we would have included in the film more, it would have been what the brigadistas talk about learning from their students. We do go into that a little bit more in 1961. I actually asked Manuel to do that because I felt like we hadn't explored it enough in Maestra. But, you know, the way the students, you know, such an important part of the campaign was breaking down that enormous divide between that urban people and rural people. And that urban people often, you know, feel superior. There's so much prejudice throughout history that urban people are superior to rural people. Urban living is superior to rural living. And people in the city are smarter and more cultured, more sophisticated, whatever. And breaking that down was such an important piece of what happened in the campaign. And developing, I actually think the teaching materials are fascinating. I don't know how much you go into that in your in your thesis and your dissertation, your master's thesis and now your dissertation, but this whole thing of, like, you know, the instrucciones al alfabetizador, that whole thing they say about, like, you know, show tremendous concern for all the problems that your students face. Illiteracy is just one of them. Like, and really sort of cultivating this deep kind of, you know, respect, like concern and respect for rural people and their challenges. So, that's a very important part, a piece of the story. And that also opened the door then for the students, the young students slash literacy teachers who went to teach on the campaign, to just honor and respect the these families that they lived with. Well, maybe they didn't know how to read and write, but they had this tremendous wisdom in so many other ways, knowledge and intelligence and traditional wisdom. And the way they talk about that is really interesting and moving, I think. So I don't know that there would be like enough volume on that to be a research project, but it sure is a beautiful topic. Y ahí para adelante.
So we have come to the end of my questions. Is there anything else that you'd like to include?
I guess, I would just really, I'm really delighted that these archives are going to UNC. I'm also, really delighted that a lot of this comes directly out of your research, and that's exciting, that, just sort of how one thing leads to another. And I know that, so many Cuba scholars go, either are cultivated at UNC or specifically go to UNC to study with Lu Perez. That it makes me particularly happy that the archives are going to be there and be at easy reach for present and future Cuba scholars. I also, though, like for anyone that's, I also would just encourage people to continue, for current and future Cuba scholars looking at the literacy campaign, I would encourage people to continue to collect interviews and do that research, because there's still so many living people, alfabetizados. There's not many, but there are some that are still alive, or children of alfabetizados. That's a huge area that could be explored. So I'm honored that, and really, really happy and honored that, that these interviews will contribute to that history. But I would encourage folks to keep collecting, searching for more. So.
Okay.